Good morning and welcome to the Friday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
Modern slavery is real, and 40 million people are trapped in it. By Guy Ryder, Andrew Forrest, and William Lacey Swing. Nearly 150 years after most countries officially abolished it, more than 40 million people remain trapped in modern slavery, either forced into labor or marriage. Women and girls account for 71% of these victims. Meanwhile, an additional 152 million children, 64 million girls, and 88 million boys are subject to child labor. Almost 1 in 10 children around the world. This may not sound like the world we think we live in, but it is. How has this seemingly anachronistic scourge taken hold? One challenge is that modern slavery takes many forms. According to a recently released study by the International Labor Organization, Walk Free Foundation, and IOM, 62% of victims are forced laborers, toiling under threat or coercion as domestic workers, in clandestine factories, on farms and fishing boats, or in the sex industry, among other sectors. Unprincipled and often criminal actors continue to exploit vulnerabilities within supply chains. An alarming 38% of modern slavery victims are trapped in forced marriages through a range of different mechanisms, including physical, emotional, or financial duress, deception by family members, the spouse, or others, or the use of force or threats or severe pressure. Modern slavery remains very much a feature of today's global economy and is present in almost every country. While the private sector forces an estimated 16 million people around the world into exploitative behavior, state authorities impose it upon another 4 million people in situations such as compulsory prison labor, compulsory labor for the purpose of economic development, and the abuse of conscription. No nation is immune from this problem. Each must design their own prevention and protection policies. Several international legal instruments can provide guidance, including the ILO's Forced Labor Convention and Protocol of 2014, the UN Instrument on Slavery and Slavery-like Practices of 1956, and the UN Protocol on Trafficking in Persons, especially Women and Children, of 2000. But law and policy must go further, focusing on prevention, on protecting victims, on remedies, and on tackling the root causes of the abuses. Greater enforcement of existing criminal laws is a critical part of any response, but extending labor rights to all those who work in the informal economy, where modern slavery is more likely to occur, is also vital if we are to protect workers from exploitation that can lead to enslavement. For example, millions of domestic workers worldwide currently fall outside the scope and protection of any labor laws. Debt bondage is also a widespread means of coercion. Over 50% of those in forced labor experience some form of debt bondage. Addressing its root causes through a focus on discrimination, social safety nets, and access to financial services is essential to tackling this particular form of exploitation. A significant share of modern slavery can be traced to failings in the migration system and thus improve migration governance by states. And all of their ministries that have responsibilities touching on the movements of people is another priority. We know that much of modern slavery today occurs in contexts of state fragility, conflict and crisis, and so we should address the risk of modern slavery as part of the humanitarian actions. For now, ending modern slavery and child labor remains a formidable challenge. We must move faster if we are to reach the ambitious target set by the UN Sustainable Development Goals of ending child labor by 2025 and modern slavery by 2030. And to make this the world we wish to live in.
Rescuers work overtime to save animals during California fires. Many perished or are still out there. By Katie Steinmetz. Monica Stevens remembers that the first calls came in at exactly 10:45 p.m. on the night that fires began to rage in California, because that's when all hell broke loose. She and her husband run Jameson Animal Rescue Ranch in St. Helena, California, nestled among the agricultural communities of Napa and Sonoma counties, as tens of thousands of people were forced to evacuate their homes during the past 2 weeks because of deadly wildfires, many found themselves feverishly wondering how to protect creatures ranging from cats and chickens to horses and goats, Her organization alone has fielded over 600 calls. There's a lot of dead animals all over the fire area, Stephen said, but there are a lot of survivors as well. As fires crept up on communities, her team of workers raced to find homes for animals and coordinate rescues, as well as deliver supplies to evacuation areas set up for large animals at local farm grounds. She recalls one couple in their 80s who live along Tubbs Lane in Napa and were forced to evacuate, kicking and screaming, because they did not want to abandon their 6 horses, along with cats and sheep. With planes spilling fire retardant overhead and the air thick with smoke, Stevens and fellow volunteers went back in with the large transport vehicle. We had to go in twice, she says, because we couldn't get all the horses in one load. Stevens estimates that as many as 3,000 animals, including hundreds of horses, were displaced because of the flames in Napa and Sonoma alone, and that just as many animals did not escape. As firefighters have made progress containing the flames, harried field operations have largely given way to the slower work of disaster recovery, which includes finding and rehabilitating animals that might have been penned in by fences that are no longer standing. Many perished or are still out there, she says. The ongoing firestorm is one of the worst that the state has ever seen, particularly in Northern California. At least 42 people have lost their lives, and about 7,000 structures have burned, as firefighters have tried to contain dozens of wildfires. While human safety has been top of mind for emergency responders and residents in stricken areas, many have been forced to leave pets behind, going back to look for them days later. In Napa, some residents stood in long lines to be escorted back to homes in evacuation areas in the days after the flames started on October 8th. They were allowed to collect only medication or animals on these initial trips back, and many held empty pet carriers as they waited. Some locals were forced to make hard choices about what to do with large animals as fires quickly approached their properties. Stevens recalls hearing from a local veterinarian that one couple in the Atlas Peak area, a part of Napa where some residents had to be airlifted to safety, decided to shoot their horses before they were enveloped by the flames. There are many stories with happier endings. Stevens has found homes for hundreds of displaced animals, ranging from llamas to ducks. Among the rescued creatures in the area was a 35-year-old tortoise that weighed 200 pounds. Deborah Blum, founder of a Santa Rosa-based animal sanctuary called Goatlandia, has doubled the amount of creatures under her care since before the fires began to just over 100. The newcomers include 14 goats, as well as a burro, pony, and a horse that she and other volunteers evacuated from property surrounding a winery in the middle of the night. One woman in the Santa Rosa area saved her 70-pound dog by putting it in a duffel bag and biking away from the danger zone. Another woman managed to get her pony out in a Honda Accord, but many tales involve teamwork as well as individual dedication to the cause. People have connected on Facebook and rescue groups, with some looking for help and some offering transport vehicles or space for animals. People will call and say, "Hey, I have 2 goats here and I need to get them out right now," Blum says. Everything from chickens to goats to horses. She credits social media with saving a lot of animal lives and says the outpouring of help in the area, ranging from the volunteers who have gone behind police lines to get animals to those now donating money for food and supplies, has been overwhelming. "We are definitely Sonoma strong." Tracy Vogt, who runs another Sonoma-based animal sanctuary called Charlie's Acres, quickly raised $7,500, using part of it to fill a trailer with horse feed and hay, which she delivered to the animal evacuation site at the Solano County Fairgrounds. Her own barn was damaged and fences leveled. "Everything was burning," she says. As of Thursday, the power and water were still not functioning at her property either, so her animals remained at a sanctuary that took them in down the California coast in Half Moon Bay. One of her brood is a pig named Gertrude that first came to Charlie's Acres after a wildfire in the area last year, so this is her second, Vox says. Among such animal advocates, there is hope that people in the area will take time during the long recovery to make plans for what to do with their animals the next time wildfires break out. In the meantime, they will keep proselytizing about how the life of every animal has value. "It's a good time to step back and see animals for more than just commodities," Blum says. "For us, they're equal."
Scenes from the Somalia You Don't See on the News by Brent Steerton. I've been fortunate to work as a photojournalist in Somalia a few times over the last 20 years. It's a fascinating and complex place. It suffers from a strange inertia in the Western mind, conjuring up cliches of the worst of Africa. Famine, civil war, Kalashnikovs, despots. We hear the word Mogadishu and immediately images from Black Hawk Down start playing in our minds. That hasn't been good for the country, and it hasn't really been fair to Somalis. Security is certainly an issue, and there are still significant threats, as this week's deadly truck bombings proved. But those threats are lessening, and the capital is changing. Islamic extremist group Al-Shabaab has hindered this progress, but the Somali army and African Union troops have pushed them back from the capital. I always meet remarkable and resilient people in Mogadishu. A Somali restaurateur who has survived multiple suicide bombers and ardently refuses to go back to London. A young fashion designer bringing color and flair to Somali women. Those same women are shopping for handbags and shoes in the newly built Mall of Somalia. Somalis are socializing on a beach that a few years ago was a joyless affair policed by Al-Shabaab, who separated men from women. Peace Park is a place crowded with the youth, many of the women in full makeup, the young men preening in their best outfits. Selfies are as ubiquitous here as in any other youth gathering on earth. The president elected in February, Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, is a U.S. citizen who spent most of his time in the U.S. advocating for the rights of minorities. Inside his office at Villa Somalia, he has a large portrait of Aden Abdullah Osman positioned directly in his line of sight. Osman was the first president of an independent Somalia, elected in 1960. President Farmajo, as he is nicknamed, says he likes to be able to look up and see that portrait. Osman lost his campaign for re-election by one vote and willingly stepped down in one of the first true acts of African political democracy. The president sees this as an inspiration for leadership in Somalia, a country he hopes to lead to stability and increased prosperity. God willing, Somalia can finally get the break its people deserve and continue inching towards progress. Inside his office at Villa Somalia, he has a large portrait of Aden Abdullah Osman. Inside his office at Villa Somalia, he has a large portrait of Aden Abdullah Osman. Inside his office at Villa Somalia, he has a large portrait of Aden Abdullah Osman positioned directly in his line of sight. Osman was the first president of an independent Somalia, elected in 1960. President Farmajo, as he is nicknamed, says he likes to be able to look up and see that portrait. Osman lost his campaign for re-election by one vote and Osman lost his campaign for re-election by one vote and willingly stepped down in one of the first true acts of African political democracy. The president sees this as an inspiration for leadership in Somalia, a country he hopes to lead to stability and increased prosperity. God willing, Somalia can finally get the break its people deserve and continue inching towards progress.
Waves of Rohingya refugees are overwhelming aid workers and authorities in Bangladesh. By Felix Solomon in Anjumanpara, Bangladesh. A trail of desperate Rohingya Muslims on the Bangladeshi border, reaching back as far as the eye can see, picked up belongings Thursday morning and began the move to what is fast becoming the world's largest refugee camp. Bangladeshi authorities initially kept the crowd waiting in paddy fields since their arrival Monday morning as response teams prepared a place for them at Kudupalong, one of two mega sites that have been home to Rohingya refugees for decades. Today, they began their long trek to the encampment. Vivian Tan, a spokesperson for the UN's refugee agency, tells Time that all of those who reach the border will be allowed to enter the crowded camps, which already shelter nearly 1 million Rohingya. Many had fled earlier waves of violence in the 1970s, 1990s, and in October 2016. The UNHCR estimates there are 10,000 to 20,000 people here in Anjumanpara, a village in the Palongkali district, mostly amassed on no man's land, awaiting permission to cross the border. There may be people who are still coming in. It's hard to say. We are seeing this expected influx now, and we've been preparing for it for a while, says Tan. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya, a persecuted minority from western Myanmar's Rakhine state, began pouring over the Bangladeshi border in the days after August 25th, when Rohingya insurgents launched a deadly attack on state security forces. The Myanmar military responded with a brutal campaign of indiscriminate killing, rape, and arson that has pushed more than half of the group's total population out of the country. The UN has called it a campaign of ethnic cleansing, and global leaders are losing patience with the Myanmar government as it continues to deny the atrocities. On Wednesday, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson pledged to hold Myanmar's military accountable for the horrendous crimes alleged over the past 2 months. The country's de facto leader, Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, claims the military operation ceased on September 5th, but new arrivals tell Time they fled their villages between 4 and 14 days ago amid the ongoing terror. Some said soldiers entered their villages and began firing at civilians. Others said mobs of ethnic Rakhine Buddhists carrying homemade weapons ransacked homes and burned them down. Lots of new Buddhists came to our area and began patrolling with local weapons, Khalida Begum, a 50-year-old Rohingya woman from Alishong village in Budadong, told Time on Tuesday as she waited in the sun for the border guards to allow the group to move. She said a Buddhist mob attacked late at night just over a week ago. They set fire to one side of our village and we were on the other, so we ran. I brought just enough to survive. Bangladesh is now dealing with a humanitarian catastrophe as more and more refugees arrive on its fields and shores each day. Barefoot, carrying small children and one bottle of water each, they keep walking. They have spent the week wading through rainy nights and blisteringly hot afternoons after their long exodus, and still it isn't over. They will be provided food, shelter, and medical assistance at the camp, but they face an uncertain future in conditions ripe for disease and despair. This is a gigantic task, said Muhammad Abdul Kalam, Joint Secretary of the Bangladesh Refugee Relief and Repatriation Commission, speaking to Time in Cox's Bazar Tuesday. We're doing our best, but when it comes to capacity, we need support. Here are the disturbing numbers on Puerto Rico 1 month after Hurricane Maria, by Joseph Hinks. On September 20th, Hurricane Maria made landfall on Puerto Rico, leaving at least 48 people dead and decimating the island's already crumbling power grid. Texas and Miami were also ravaged by severe weather in the two hurricanes that preceded Maria, but relief efforts there quickly restored basic infrastructure. 1 month on, however, much of the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico still looks the way it did immediately after the hurricane receded northwest towards the Dominican Republic. Here is a by-the-numbers account of how things on the island currently stand. Provisions. More than a third of Puerto Rican households, or about 1 million people, still lack running water, according to CNN. FEMA says it's distributed 23.6 million liters of bottled and bulk water in Puerto Rico. That figure includes water for hospitals and dialysis centers. These deliveries equate to only 9% of the island's drinking water requirement, going by the World Health Organization's assessment that each person needs at least 2.5 liters per day. Some residents are so desperate for drinking water, they've broken into polluted wells at industrial waste sites. The shortfall is far greater when you consider the WHO also recommends 15 liters per person per day for basic cooking and hygiene needs. Dirty water ups the risk of diseases like cholera, and at least one person has died as a result of being unable to get to dialysis treatment on time, CNN reports. Some 86% of grocery stores have reopened, but they're not necessarily stocked. And FEMA says 60,000 homes need roofing help. It's delivered 38,000 tarps. Power and personnel. Less than 20% of Puerto Rico's power grid has been restored, and around 3 million people are still without power, says CNN. The news broadcaster adds that 75% of antennas are down, so even those able to charge phones are unlikely to have cellular service. All of the island's hospitals are now up and running, with most using backup systems, but only a quarter are being supplied with power from the grid, says Axios. According to CNN, FEMA has deployed 1,700 personnel in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, which were also ravaged by Hurricane Maria. That's 900 less than the 2,600 FEMA personnel reportedly still in Texas and Florida. But the agency told CNN that around 20,000 other federal staff and military have been deployed in response to Maria. Thousands of people have donated money or volunteered to help Puerto Rico. Among them, celebrity chef Jose Andres says he's serving 100,000 meals a day on the island. Publicity and the president. 5 days after Maria made landfall, the first Trump administration officials traveled to Puerto Rico to survey the damage. That evening, Trump made his first tweet since the storm hit, mentioning the debt Puerto Rico owes Wall Street. He'd spent the preceding days at his golf club in New Jersey. It took a further 8 days, almost 2 weeks after the hurricane hit, for Trump to visit Puerto Rico. The 5 hours he spent there were marked by him tossing paper towels, jump shot style, into a crowd of residents. Trump later said in a tweet that Puerto Rico's crushing $72 billion in public debt should be wiped out. A tweet criticizing the mayor of San Juan ranked the third least popular of all Trump's tweets since he assumed office, according to a metric that pits comments against likes. The approval rating on his handling of hurricanes also dropped 20% in the wake of Maria. President Trump's tweets about Puerto Rico military families rank among his 10 worst received ever, by Ryan Teague Beckwith and Pratik Rabala. President Trump's handling of Puerto Rico and military deaths rank among his worst under a popular metric for measuring responses to tweets. It's called the ratio, and it refers to tweets that get more replies than likes. Since there's no way to downvote a tweet, a high number of replies without likes is typically a sign that many users were disagreeing with you. Because Trump has so many followers, 40 million under the most recent count, making him the most followed world leader on the social networking platform, it's fairly hard for him to get a bad ratio. Only one tweet about Morning Joe co-host Mika Brzezinski received more replies than likes, the measure of a poorly received tweet. But several tweets in September and October about Puerto Rico, military families, an Alabama Senate race, and his relationship with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson rank among his worst ratios of replies to likes since he became president. Here's a list of his top 10 tweets according to the ratio, according to an analysis by Time. Criticizing Morning Joe host Mika Brzezinski, 89,000 replies, 79,000 likes. To Mar-a-Lago 3 nights in a row around New Year's Eve and insisted on joining me. She was bleeding badly from a facelift. I said no. Lamenting the failure of the skinny Obamacare repeal. 92,000 replies, 92,000 likes. 3 Republicans and 48 Democrats let the American people down. As I said from the beginning, let Obamacare implode, then deal. Watch. Attacking the mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico. 53,000 replies, 57,000 likes. Such poor leadership ability by the mayor of San Juan and others in Puerto Rico who are not able to get their workers to help. responding to the loss of a Senate candidate he backed. 44,000 replies, 47,000 likes. In analyzing the Alabama primary race, fake news always fails to mention that the candidate I endorsed went up many points after the endorsement. Criticizing an account of his phone call with a military widow, 63,000 replies, 73,000 likes. Democrat Congresswoman totally fabricated what I said to the wife of a soldier who died in action, and I have proof. Sad. Promoting his administration's efforts in Puerto Rico, 65,000 replies, 78,000 likes. Nobody could have done what I've done for Puerto Rico with so little appreciation, so much work. Arguing that emergency response in Puerto Rico can't last forever, 53,000 replies, 65,000 likes. We cannot keep FEMA, the military, and the first responders, who have been amazing under the most difficult circumstances, in Puerto Rico forever. Criticizing an NBC News report about Secretary of State Rex Tillerson allegedly calling him a moron, 77,000 replies, 99,000 likes. With all of the fake news coming out of NBC and the networks, at what point is it appropriate to challenge their license? Bad for country. Responding to former FBI Director James Comey's accounts of their interactions, 59,000 replies, 76,000 likes. James Comey better hope that there are no tapes of our conversations before he starts leaking to the press. Responding to coverage of Michael Flynn's resignation, 84,000 replies, 110,000 likes. The real story here is, why are there so many illegal leaks coming out of Washington? Will these leaks be happening as I deal on North Korea, etc.? Do this one thing each year if you want a better retirement. By Walter Updegrave. There's a time-honored way to manage your investment risks while smoothing out the ups and downs in the value of your nest egg on the journey to and through retirement. Unfortunately, many investors aren't taking advantage of the simple but effective technique known as rebalancing. A recent Wells Fargo Gallup survey found that fewer than half of investors bother to restore their portfolios back to a target mix of stocks and bonds at least once a year. In fact, 30% claimed they'd rather be stuck in traffic for an hour than rebalance. This is a shame, because failing to periodically go through the exercise of selling assets that have been soaring and plowing the proceeds into lagging investments can leave you more vulnerable to market setbacks. The case for rebalancing. For example, let's say that based on your risk tolerance, you decided back in early 2009 to invest 70% of your savings in stocks and 30% in bonds. If you reinvested all gains but failed to rebalance, the huge run-up in stock prices over the past 8.5 years would have transformed your portfolio mix to nearly 90% stocks and 10% bonds today. In short, you would be sitting on a far more aggressive portfolio than you started out with. That could leave you nursing much larger losses than you may be prepared to handle should the current bull market end, like many of its predecessors, in a deep and prolonged bear market. Even worse, a bigger than expected setback might rattle you so much that you end up selling off much of your stock stake, disrupting your long-term investing strategy, possibly relegating you to subpar returns and ultimately less retirement income. Rebalancing can also be a way to prevent your portfolio from becoming more conservative than you intend it to be. Let's say, for example, that someone who retired in 2007, just before the onset of the financial crisis, decided that a mix of 60% stocks and 40% bonds was appropriate for generating the retirement income he'd need. Since stocks got hit with a 37% loss in 2008, while bonds gained a little over 5%, stocks would have dwindled to less than 50% of that portfolio by the end of the year, essentially making bonds, rather than stocks, the larger holding. By rebalancing, in this case, selling some bonds and reinvesting the proceeds in stocks, the retiree would not only bring his portfolio back to its proper proportions, but also better position it to participate in the market's rebound the following year, 2009, when the Standard & Poor's 500 index surged to a near 27% gain versus a more modest 6% return for bonds. The case for annual rebalancing. While most advisors agree about the benefits of rebalancing, there's no consensus on how often you ought to do it. Some say once a year is fine, while others recommend quarterly, monthly, or even daily rebalancing. Still others contend that you should rebalance only when your portfolio strays too far from its target allocation, say when a 60% stock position slips below 50% or rises above 70%. You can make a case for any of these regimens, but I think annual rebalancing, generally near the end of the year so you can combine it with any tax-related investment moves, makes sense for most people. For one thing, I don't think most investors have the discipline to actually adhere to a more frequent rebalancing schedule. Rebalancing once a year can also reduce the transaction costs and taxes you could incur from the selling required to restore your portfolio to its appropriate proportions. You can also reduce any tax hit by confining your rebalance-related selling as much as possible to 401ks, IRAs, and other tax-advantaged accounts. For that matter, if your portfolio's proportions haven't gone too far out of whack, you may be able to bring your portfolio back to its target allocation without incurring transaction costs and any tax hit by funneling any new investment dollars into whichever asset has lagged over the past year, rather than selling shares of assets that have gained in value. And you may not have to do anything at all in years when there's not a huge difference in the annual returns earned by different segments of your portfolio. In 2015, for example, stocks gained a little less than 1.5%, while bonds returned roughly 1.5%, while bonds returned roughly 0.5%. Which means a portfolio that began the year invested 70% in stocks and 30% in bonds would have finished the year with a 70.2 to 29.8% stocks-bonds mix, hardly enough of a change to warrant rebalancing. The case for automatic rebalancing. Some people will never get around to rebalancing no matter how little effort is required or how compelling the case for doing it may be. If you're one of them, then you may want to consider having someone else do your rebalancing for you. Some 401k plans, for example, allow you to opt for automatic rebalancing or offer a tool that allows you to do it with a single click. You can also opt for investments such as managed accounts and target date funds that do the rebalancing on their own. Of course, rebalancing makes sense only if you have a target allocation to rebalance back to. That is, you've gone to the trouble of deciding on an asset allocation reflects. That is, you've gone to the trouble of deciding on an asset allocation that reflects your appetite for risk and takes your investment goals into account. You can determine what asset allocation makes the most sense for you by going to Vanguard's Risk Tolerance Asset Allocation Tool, which you'll find along with other helpful tools and resources in Real Deal Retirement's Retirement Toolbox section. Finally, keep in mind that as you age and get closer to retirement, you may want to shift to a more conservative allocation to better preserve the savings you've accumulated and to avoid a big setback on the eve of retirement. So every few years or so, it's a good idea to revisit that allocation tool to make sure your stocks-bonds mix is still appropriate. If it's not, you can rebalance to your new target mix. But what you don't want to do is just let your retirement portfolio ride. Do that and you'll likely end up taking more risk than you intend in some years, less in others, and you'll have turned over control of your investment strategy to the financial markets. These are the 5 Youngest Billionaires in America by Jennifer Kalfas. 3 of them are self-made and the other 2 are heirs, but they all have 3 things in common. They're young, they're American, and they're billionaires. On Tuesday, Forbes released its annual Forbes 400 list, which chronicles the 400 richest billionaires in the United States. While Forbes says the average age of the billionaires on the list is 67, several of its members are far younger, with two of them in their 20s and 14 under the age of 40. Its five youngest members have ages spanning from their mid-20s to early 30s. Snapchat co-founder Evan Spiegel was once again the youngest billionaire on the list at age 27, and his partner, Bobby Murphy, was the second youngest at age 29. The two co-founders are each worth $3.1 billion, according to Forbes, and have been the youngest members of the list since 2014. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, 33, was just edged out as one of the five youngest on the list with the addition of Rishi Shah, the co-founder and CEO of Outcome Health. Of course, Zuckerberg did make the top five on the list overall when it just came down to his staggering net worth of $71 billion. Forbes's full ranking of the 400 richest billionaires in the U.S. was more competitive this year than ever before, with the benchmark to make the list rising to $2 billion. That means 169 billionaires were left out, Forbes wrote. The majority of the list's members are men, including all 14 billionaires who are under the age of 40. As for its five youngest members, here's how they made their wealth. Number one, Evan Spiegel, 27. Spiegel has yet to be dethroned as the youngest billionaire in the U.S. This year, the Stanford dropout added another title to his resume, the youngest CEO of a public company, Snap, the parent company of Snapchat. Spiegel and Murphy took Snap public in March, though its stock price has dropped significantly since its IPO. Spiegel has a net worth of $3.1 billion, about $1 billion lower than before his company went public. Spiegel owns 18% of the company. Number two, Bobby Murphy, 29. Like Spiegel, Murphy owns 18% of Snap. At 29 years old, Murphy has a net worth of $3.1 billion. Murphy met Spiegel while they were undergraduates at Stanford, where they were in the same fraternity. They created the idea of the disappearing photo app while students. Snapchat has faced some difficulty in recent months, however, as Instagram and Facebook have attempted to compete with their Stories features, which allows users to post images that last for 24 hours or until they're deleted. Number three, Lucas Walton, 31. While little is known about Walton, he has an impressive amount of money, especially for his age. Walton is the grandson of Walmart founder Sam Walton and has a net worth of $13.2 billion, according to Forbes. Walton inherited his wealth from his father, John Walton, after he died in a plane crash in 2005. The 31-year-old graduated from Colorado College and is the 33rd richest billionaire on the Forbes 400 list overall. Number 4, Rishi Shah, 31. With a net worth of $3.6 billion, Shah is a new addition to the Forbes 400 list, according to the magazine. As its CEO, Shah owns 80% of Outcome Health, a healthcare technology company that places touchscreens and tablets in doctors' offices. Shah started the company 10 years ago with Shraja Agarwal, the company's president. Outcome Health has placed devices in 20% of doctors' offices across the United States, the company says. Shah also appeared in Fortune's 40 Under 40 this year. And number 5, Julio Mario Santo Domingo III, 32. Julio Mario Santo Domingo III is a DJ, but that's not how he got his $2.4 billion. Domingo is the heir to a beer fortune, which he inherited from his late father and grandfather, according to Forbes. His grandfather had a stake in SAB Miller, and his father died in 2009. Domingo now has a stake in Anheuser-Busch InBev since it acquired SAB Miller last year. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.